I needed for the attack and could now sit tight. The old woman had just come out of the door next to mine and was heading along the corridor away from me with rumpled sheets in her arms. The room was probably rented by the hour, and she was mucking out after the latest event. With the faint sound of the talk show in the distance, I checked the telltale. It hadn't moved. I opened the door and waited for the heat to hit me. As I took the first step inside, I knew straight away that something wasn't right. The plastic log-effect fire wasn't dancing round the walls, but it had been when I left. I dropped the stuff I was carrying. The brick hit the carpet as I started to step back into the corridor. And that was the last thing I did for a while, apart from trying to get off the bedroom floor, only to get a blow to the kidneys that put me back down. It was grit the teeth and curl up time. There was no time to draw breath. I was roughly turned over and a weapon muzzle was pushed hard into my face. I felt my jacket being pulled up as a hand frisked me. Once I'd curled up again and played nearly dead, I risked opening my eyes. The oldest of the Goodfellas towered above me, wearing his silver fur hat and black leather coat. I could also see another pair of legs belonging to someone else, also in black. The two men stood on either side of me now, whispering aggressively to each other with lots of arm movement and pointing at the dickhead on the floor. I made the most of this time while they waffled, trying to take long, deep breaths, but finding I couldn't. It was too painful. I had to get by with short, sharp gasps, trying to minimize the pain in my stomach. Then I looked up and saw Carpenter. Our eyes locked and he spat at me. I wasn't scared, I was just depressed that this should be happening to me. So much so that I couldn't even be bothered to wipe the mucus from my face. I just lay there, not really caring. How had Carpenter even known I was here? Fuck it. Who cared? I'd been dropped by two very pissed off people, and I didn't know if I was ever going to leave the room alive. They pulled me up by my armpits, one man on each side, and propped me up on the end of the bed. Pushing my hands into my armpits, I tried to bend forwards and get my head down onto my thighs to protect myself, to be the damaged grey man that was no threat to anybody. It wasn't going to happen. I took a blow on the right side of my face, which took me straight down onto the bed. I didn't need to pretend. It had done me some damage. Expecting more, I curled up on my side. Starbursts did their best to black me out as pain scorched through my body. I could feel myself starting to lose it, and I really couldn't let that happen. I worked hard to keep my eyes open. I was a bag of shit, but I knew that I had to pull myself together or I'd be dead. The two of them were still talking, arguing, I couldn't tell which. In the background, somewhere. I just lay there taking short, sharp breaths, keeping my eyes open and coughing blood onto the furry blanket. My jaw joint was grinding on itself. I probed with my tongue and discovered one of my side teeth moving as a numb, swollen feeling developed on the right side of my face. I felt as if I'd just had a session with a psychopathic dentist. With my head on the bed, I was level and in a direct line with the coffee table. My fuzzy vision locked onto the large glass ashtray. I switched my attention to Carpenter and the old guy. They didn't even stop their waffle as a couple of people passed our door, heading towards the end of the corridor. The older guy had a pistol in his hand. Carpenter had his weapon in a shoulder holster, which I could see as he put his hands on his hips and pulled back on his unzipped jacket. They were both pointing at me. Carpenter seemed to be explaining who I was, or at least what I had done. I could also see now what the older guy had hit me with. His hands could have done the job just as well, judging by the size of them, but he'd opted for a leather strop that looked like a big dildo, and which was probably filled with ball bearings. The two of them were a couple of meters to one side of me, and the ashtray was 1 meter to the other. Both men were still more interested in their argument than in me, but would no doubt come to a decision very soon as to how to kill me. Probably slowly if Carpenter had anything to do with it. I had to act, but I also knew that first I had to take a few seconds to sort myself out. I was still fazed, I'd have to break my actions down into stages in my head, or I was going to fuck up and get killed. I squinted at the heavy lump of glass on the table that might save my life, and, taking a deep breath, I sprang off the bed. Keeping my head down, I charged at the two black shapes in front of me. All I needed was to get them off balance to give me just a few seconds. Holding out my arms, I bulldozed into the two lots of black leather and, not waiting to see what happened to them, I swung my head round and looked for the ashtray. A wheezy gasp came from behind me as they made contact with the wall. Eyes still fixed on the glass shape on the table, my body pivoted as my legs started to move towards it. Muffled shouts came from behind. That didn't matter. The ashtray did. If they were fast enough to recover, or I was too slow to react, I would never know about it. Slapping down my palm, as if swatting a fly, I gripped the ashtray. My body was still facing the table with the two guys behind me. Swinging my head round, I focused on the old guy's now hatless head. My body turned as I took the three paces towards him, brandishing the fistful of glass in the air like a knife. I closed in, ignoring Carpenter as he came towards me from the right. The one I wanted was the old guy, the one with the pistol in his hand. His face didn't register surprise or fear, just anger, as he pushed himself off the wall and raised his weapon. My eyes were fixed on his face as I swung the ashtray downwards, making contact above his cheekbone. His skin folded over just below his eye, then split open. He fell with a scream, his body banging against my legs on the way down. Stage three was complete. I heard, rather than saw, the black shape from the right, almost on top of me. I didn't have a stage four. It was open house now. Not even bothering to turn and look at Carpenter, I just lashed out wildly. The thick glass hammered against his skull twice on his way down, both times with such force that my arm jarred to a halt as I made contact. I jumped onto his chest and continued to rain blows onto the top of his head. Somewhere in the back of my mind I knew I'd lost it, but I didn't care. I was just remembering the way this fucker had kept firing rounds into the woman in the lift, and the bastards who'd ruined Kelly's life by hosing down her family in Washington. Three times, there was a crunching, cracking sound as his skull gave way. I raised my hand ready to hit again, but stopped myself. I'd done enough. Thick, almost brown blood oozed from his head wounds. He had lost function in his eyes and had a vacant stare, wide open and dull, pupils fully dilated. The blood spread onto the carpet, which soaked it up like blotting paper. Still sitting astride him, I rested both hands on his chest, not enjoying the fact that I'd lost control. To survive, you sometimes have to get really revved up. But losing it completely, I didn't like that. I turned to check the old guy. The strop and the handgun were on the floor, and so was he, curled up, holding his hat against his face like a dressing and moaning to himself. His legs flailed weakly on the carpet. Slowly hauling myself to my feet, I kicked away both weapons. The gun looked like a .38 special revolver, the short-barreled sort used by 1930s American gangsters. Pulling his jacket off his shoulders and midway down his arms, I dragged him over the top of Carpenter and into the bathroom, leaving his blood-stained fur hat behind. It was obvious now why he always wore it. Only a few wisps of hair covered his head. He was still moaning and probably feeling quite sorry for himself, but he was alive, and that meant he was a threat. My jaw was aching as I jolted up and down with the effort of dragging him, but at least my heart rate was starting to calm. There was no other option. He had to die. I wasn't happy about it, but I couldn't leave him here alive when I set off for the Malaskaya compound tomorrow. He could compromise everything I was here for. I let go of him, and he slumped onto the tiled bathroom floor. I turned on the hot water, and the geezer surged into action. The extent of the injury to his face was now clear to me. A 2-centimeter furrow was gouged in his cheek, wide enough to put a couple of fingers in. Beneath the mess of torn flesh, gleamed an area of exposed white cheekbone. A check of his wallets as he lay and groaned to himself revealed all the normal stuff. Only the money was of interest, both Russian and Estonian. Once that was tucked into my jeans, I went back into the bedroom. Stepping back over Carpenter, I picked up the .38 special from the floor and one of the furry blankets. I pulled back the hammer so the weapon was cocked. When I came to squeeze the trigger, I didn't want the hammer moving all the way back before coming forward to fire the round. It might get caught in the blanket. I walked back into the bathroom and, not even looking at his face in case his eyes were on me, I unceremoniously jammed the muzzle into the blanket and onto his head, quickly wrapped the furry nylon around the weapon, and fired. There was a dull thud, and then a crack as the round exited his head and shattered the tile beneath it. I let the blanket fall and cover his face and listened. There was no apparent reaction to the round from outside the room. This was the sort of place where you didn't ask too many questions, even if there was a gangfuck going on next door. The only things my senses picked up were the noise of the geezer and the smell of burned nylon. I turned the water off, and the geezer died as I moved into the bedroom. I dug out Carpenter's wallet and tucked his money into my jeans too. His weapon was still in its shoulder holster, but only just. I realized how lucky I had been. Another fraction of a second, and it could have been a totally different story. The pistol was a Makarov, a Russian copy of James Bond's Walther PPK, and only good as a close-up, personal protection weapon, perfect for when someone got the hump with you in a comfort bar. At longer range, it would be more lethal to throw the thing at them. No wonder its nickname in certain quarters was the disco gun. I decided to keep this one. The pistol grip on these Russian versions was bulky, making it awkward to get a firm hold first time when drawing down with small hands like mine. But it was more use than the .38 special. Carpenter's blood was thickening on the carpet, which couldn't absorb the amount leaking out of him. Pulling another blanket off the bed, I trod it down around his head to try and stop it seeping through the floorboards. I ended up grabbing his head and wrapping it in the blanket. I opened the main door into the corridor, checked left and right, then had a look at the intact telltale. Why had it failed me? Why was it still in place? I could see the answer at once. It was stuck to the doorframe. The sponge, strip, draft excluder must have been put there soon after the stuff was invented. It was now brown and gooey with age. Lesson learned. Don't mix telltales with old draft excluders. Switching the fire back on, I rolled up my sleeves and got to work. Chapter 38. I used the toilet plunger handle again to prevent burning my hands, wedging it into a mine cap and fishing it out, then turning it upside down to drain. I carried it like that into the bedroom, treading on the old man's hat on the way. The blood hadn't soaked in as much as it had into the carpet or blanket, which probably meant the fur was real and was resisting penetration. Laying the mine on the coffee table, I crossed the room to open the window, letting in the cold sea air big time. Waves were breaking on the other side of the road. The explosive, which had been more or less rigid plastic, was now soft enough to extract and manipulate. I began to scoop, having first put a carrier bag over each hand to prevent the nitro from entering my bloodstream via cuts on my hands or straightforward absorption. It wouldn't kill. Hospitals use nitroglycerin on heart attack victims, but it would give me a massive fuck-off headache. By the time I'd finished, the room stank of marzipan, and in front of me on the table was 10 pounds of what looked like green, lumpy plasticine. It had hardened a little as it cooled, but I knew that once I played with it in my hands a bit, it would become quite pliable again. The remaining 2 pounds or so of PE were stubbornly sticking to the sides of the mine and were too difficult to get out, so I just left it. With the bags rustling on my hands, I worked away at it as if kneading dough, trying to keep my head turned so the fumes didn't get to me so quickly. Even so, it made me feel dizzy and nauseous, though that might also have something to do with the way Carpenter and the old guy had greeted me at the door. Once I'd got it all nice and malleable in three equal-sized balls, I pulled off the rubber part of the plunger and used the handle as a rolling pin to flatten them out. The smell of marzipan reminded me of being a kid at Christmas, binning the icing sugar and going straight for the yellow stuff underneath. As I played mum, the room adjacent to my bedroom was about to become a love nest. There was the rattle of a key. The door opened and closed, and then I heard voices. But this wasn't fun sex talk. This was heavy, serious stuff. I kept rolling as the hooker ran through her repertoire of moans and sighs, though not giggly ones like before. This sounded more like grand opera. The sounds of male grunting and rhythmic humping started almost straight away. Poor girl. She probably hadn't even had time to put down her bag of chips. When the dough was about a quarter of an inch thick and the diameter of a medium takeaway pizza, I used the ice scraper to cut strips about 2 inches wide, getting 6 per base. That done, I stepped over the head into the blood-soaked blanket, went into the bathroom and pulled the plug to refill the bath with more hot water. The old man's eyes were fixed open in an astonished stare. I ignored him as I turned on the tap and tested the water as if for a baby's bath, wishing I could stay in here because the geezer noise drowned out the duets next door. But there were 5 more minds to be dealt with. Leaving the bath still running, I went back to the bedroom with another piece of dripping Soviet war machinery hanging off the plunger. It was now so cold in the room that my nose was beginning to drip. Wiping it carefully on my jacket sleeve to make sure I got none of the marzipan on my exposed skin, I sat back down with more pee in a can and set about digging out the contents. Plastic explosive is nothing more than a substance which, when detonated, undergoes almost instantaneous decomposition. Until that moment, most forms of the compound are harmless and waterproof. You can even burn some types of pee and it won't explode. It'll just help you make a brew very quickly. When detonated, however, it delivers a shattering blow known as brisance. And that is why it can be used to cut through materials as strong as steel. I still had another 4 mines to empty and was gagging for that brew. But I didn't think they did room service here. Not the kind I wanted, anyway. I just got on with it, gouging out the PE, rolling and cutting 2-inch-wide strips, serenaded by the bear next door, who sounded as though he was heading for his final grunt. I hoped he might follow it with a spell of hibernation. An hour or so later, with all of the PE now in strips, I opened the knife blade of the Leatherman and rested it over the hot bar of the fire. I then laid the first piece of foam on the bed base down. Carpenter was pissing me off, as I had to keep stepping over him, so I pulled at his feet, his head making a dull thud as it hit the thin carpet as it moved out of the blanket, and dragged him closer to the door. Once there, I rearranged the sodden blanket once more around his head and wiped my hands on his black crew neck. Using the towel as an oven glove, I lifted the hot Leatherman from the fire and quickly sliced off all the little lumps, bumps, and moulded corners from the upper side of the foam. What I was left with was a meter square, one side naturally flat, the other cut more or less level. Next, I used the hot blade to mark out a 2-inch-wide channel all the way round, following the line of the square and about 3 inches in from the edge. The smell of burning polystyrene was even more overpowering than the marzipan. Holding the blade at an angle, I started cutting an inverted V in the channel, ending up with what looked like a trench all around the foam square, with 4 very long bars of Toblerone lying in the bottom of it, peaks upwards. The strips of explosive would be laid along the sides of the Toblerone, and when the frame charge was complete, it would be the flat side that would ultimately be placed against the target. You can't drop a bridge by just dangling big sticks of dynamite against it. To cut through whatever you're trying to destroy, concrete, brick, or steel, with the least amount of PE and maximum effect, you have to channel the brisance by using the Monroe effect. Because of the 30-degree angle made by the peak of the Toblerone facing the target, the majority of the detonation force would surge towards the imaginary chocolate bar's base and beyond. Had the Toblerone been made of copper, the brisance would be able to penetrate many inches of steel, because the detonation would melt the copper and take most of the molten flow forward with it, cutting through the target. I didn't have copper, just styrofoam, but there was enough force in the PE alone to do the job required of it. My nitro headache was really pounding now. I downed another 4 aspirin, only 4 more left. As I went back to my cutting, the sound of an argument between 2 men filtered through from the corridor. They were soon joined by a woman who seemed to be charming them down. The door opposite mine opened and closed, and there was silence. I waited for the customary sound effects to start in the room opposite, but all I got was more argument. The woman now chipping in her 2 eeks worth. When I'd finished cutting the Toblerone shape all the way round the polystyrene, the base of the triangle was just over 1.5 inches from the base of the foam. This was the standoff, which would give the Monroe effect space to gather enough force to cut through the target's brickwork. Now all I had to do was lay the explosive along each side of the Toblerone and over its peak, making sure the strips were moulded together seamlessly to make 1 big charge. Protecting my hands with the plastic bags once more, I started placing, pressing and pinching, as if shaping and joining pastry. The 3-way argument was still going on opposite. I didn't mind. It was nice to have neighbours who were talking instead of grunting and throwing the bed around. Once the Toblerone was covered by 2 layers of PE, I got some detcord and cut off 2 lengths. One about 3 feet long, the other about 5. Putting 2 knots into 1 end of each length, I pressed these into the PE that lay over the Toblerone, on 2 opposite sides of the square. To keep the knots in place, 2 offcuts of PE were pressed down on top so the knots were well and truly moulded into the charge. The reason for having 2 sights for the detcord was that I needed the detonation to come from 2 directions simultaneously, so the charge was more efficient. To make sure that happened, I tightly taped together over a distance of about 6 inches, the 2 different lengths of detcord so that, from the binding to the charge, they were both of equal length. Trailing from the site of the binding was the 2-foot surplus from the longer piece. That bit was called the det tail. As the shockwave travelled along the det tail and reached the binding, it would also detonate the 2nd, shorter length of detcord. The 2 shockwaves would then travel down towards the charge at the same speed and distance, therefore reaching the Toblerones on 2 opposing sides simultaneously. The Monroe effect would direct the force of the detonation towards the base of the Toblerone, gathering energy as it travelled the 1 inch through the foam before impacting the target. All being well, I should be left with a gaping hole about 1 meter square in the wall of the target house. I was still in the process of taping over the Toblerone to keep it in the foam, when 2 male voices, drunk and laughing, came up the stairs and past my door, going into the room on the other side of the bathroom. I still had another charge to make, so I put the knife back on the fire as my 2 new neighbours laughed, joked, and turned the TV on loudly. At least it drowned out the 3 still entertaining themselves opposite. It took me 30 minutes to complete the 2nd charge, done to the accompaniment of an American comedy, dubbed, of course. I prefer the jokes in Russian. To make them easier to carry, I sandwiched both sets of charges together so the Toblerone peaks were facing each other, storing the attached detcord in between. I wrapped one of the tow ropes around to keep it all together, then slid 2 of the pallet sections, taken from behind the shops, under the rope. I'd also secured the reel of unused detcord to the pack by running the rope through its center while wrapping it round. Everything I'd be needing on target was now together, and the whole thing looked like a badly packed Boy Scout's rucksack. There were 1 or 2 other little jobs to do before I could get out of here. Gathering together the remaining blue nylon tow ropes, I tied them together until there was 1 rope about 30 meters long, adding extra knots so that there was 1 every meter. 1 end was then tied onto the rope, which had been wrapped around the charges. Next, I picked up the 3rd length of pallet wood. It was MI9 time again as I cut a groove all round 1 end, about 3 inches in from the top, around which I secured the free end of the rope attached to the charges. Holding the brick against the unroped end of the wood so that its longest edge was parallel to the planks, I wrapped the towel around both and secured it with yards of insulating tape. All the equipment was now prepared. The Lion King told me it was 3:28. In theory, too early to leave. But I didn't know who else knew that Carpenter and the old man had come to visit. The threesome started arguing yet again, this time probably about payment, as I took the charges, draped in a blanket, down to the car. Chapter 39. Saturday, 18th of December, 1999. In the pitch dark of the afternoon, I drove west towards Tallinn on the main drag, turned left to Pusi, and headed once again over the railway track and towards the target, passing the sad shacks where people were holed up for the winter. In the 12 hours since leaving the hotel, I'd been cruising around, stopping only a couple of times to fill up with petrol. Anything to keep the heater going. On my way out, I'd paid the old woman for another 2 nights, so with any luck, there should be no need for her to come and check the room. Tented stools were dotted along the roads like miniature service stations, the steam that poured from their vents making them look like refugee camp field kitchens. When I stopped to buy coffee and pastries, it actually helped to have a swollen mouth with visible bruising, because I could get away with just mumbling and pointing. The problem came when I tried to eat and drink. My tooth was killing me, and these places didn't sell Nurofen. My last 4 aspirins had gone hours ago. I'd kept Carpenter's weapon on me, and the .38 Special was in the glove compartment. Neither of them had spare rounds. Now, sliding slowly along the single-track road, my headlights picked up the concrete wall of the target on my left. Nothing appeared to have changed. There were still no lights or movement, and the gates were still closed. Parking in the same driveway as before, I turned off the engine and sat for a while in the rapidly cooling car, running through the plan one last time. It didn't take long, because there wasn't really much of a plan. Forcing myself out into the cold, now wearing the old guy's gloves and blood-stained fur hat, I covered the driver's side of the windscreen with newspaper before taking the charges out of the boot. The tow rope, wrapped around them, made a handy shoulder strap. Finally, I hid the key under the rear right wheel. If I got caught by the Malaskaya, then at least they wouldn't have my keys if I managed to escape. What was more, I could tell Tom if I linked up with him, and he would also have a means of escape if I didn't make it to the car. I wasn't going to kill him. I owed him that much after what he'd done by the fence at the Finn's house. What was more, I didn't want his death on my conscience, as well as Kelly's illness. At first I'd put my change of heart down to the fact that I wasn't thinking of saving Tom's skin as much as my own. He would be the only one who could back up my story to Lynn if this whole thing went completely to ratchet. And why shouldn't it? Everything else had so far. But then, much as I hated the idea, I had to admit to myself that I'd come to like the chubby-cheeked fucker. He might not be the sort of bloke I was used to associating with, and we certainly wouldn't be seeing each other for coffee mornings. But he was all right, and he needed a break as much as I did. I'd been toying with the idea since I lay in my cheap hotel room in Helsinki. That was why I'd brought his passport with me, just in case I decided. It was as cold as ever, but as I walked along the road I tied up my new fur hat ear flaps so I could listen. Drawing level with the hangar and its funnel, I still couldn't hear any noise from inside the compound. I reached the driveway leading to the large steel plate gates, turned and took a few paces towards them. Then I stopped and listened. Now that I knew it was there, I could just make out the generator churning away in the distance. Apart from that, I could hear nothing. I tested the gates, but they weren't open. I tried the small door set into the larger right-hand one, but again they were still locked. I wasn't expecting it to be that easy, but I'd have felt like a real dickhead if I'd gone to all the trouble of climbing over the wall when all I had to do was stroll in through the front gate. Lying down in the right-hand tire rut, with the charges behind me, I pressed my eye to the gap beneath. Nothing that side of the gate had changed. There were still 2 lights on the ground floor, and the larger building to the right was just as dark. I wasn't sure if what I was looking at was good or bad, not that it mattered that much. I was still going to get amongst it and destroy the place, and hopefully find Tom. Once on my feet again, with the Boy Scout rucksack re-shouldered, I started back in the direction of the car. But about 70 or 80 meters past the hangar, I stepped left off the road and into the high snow. My aim was to walk out into the fields, turn left, and approach the hangar from the rear. I couldn't prevent leaving a trail in the snow, but at least I could try to keep most of it out of sight of the road. The snow had a thin layer of ice on top, and varied in depth from calf to thigh height. As I pressed my foot down on the not-so-deep stuff, there was initial resistance, then my weight pushed through it. In the deeper drifts, I felt like an icebreaker in the Baltic. I laboured on, my jeans soaking and my legs starting to freeze. At least there wasn't much cloud and my night vision was adjusting to the starlight. The rear of the hangar loomed in front of me and I climbed inside. The floor was concrete, and the steel structure supported what looked like corrugated asbestos. Moving slowly and carefully towards the wall of the compound, after about 20 paces I began to make out the dark shape of the doorway. When I reached the edge of the hangar, I stood still and listened. Not a sound, just the gentle moan of the wind. Wading across the 5 or 6 meters of snow between the two buildings, I realized as soon as I reached the door that I was going to be disappointed. The metal was a lot older than the front gates, and was flaking with rust. The door itself was solid, with no hinges or locks this side of it. I pushed, but there wasn't a hint of movement. Turning right, I followed the wall and waded 15 meters further away from the road. Hopefully I was now facing the gable end of the larger building on the other side of the concrete. Placing the charges on the snow, I unraveled the rope attached to the plank with the brick at the end. With just 2 or 3 feet of slack, I started swinging it around me like a hammer thrower, finally letting go with upwards momentum to make the plank clear the wall. I'd never make the Highland Games. The whole lot fell back down in front of me. I was just sorting out the rope for another try when vehicle lights raked the wall of the compound. I dropped to my knees, ready to bury myself in the snow. Then I realized that on my knees I was buried in it. The lights got stronger, disappearing for half a second as the vehicle dipped in the road, only to light up the sky before settling down again. As it got closer, the inside of the hangar was lit up and moving shadows were cast by the steel supports. The ponderous chug of a big diesel told me that a tractor was heading in my direction. I felt good about that. If the Malaskaya were coming for me, I doubted they'd be riding a massive Ferguson. The noise got louder, and the lights even stronger, until the tractor burst into view in the gap between the compound wall and the hangar. It looked like some old relic from a Soviet collective, with far more silhouettes in the cab than the thing was designed for. Maybe the local pub quiz team was heading down to the Hammer and Sickle for a few pints of vodka. The lights and noise gradually faded, and I got on with my task. It took me 2 more tries, but I eventually got the plank to sail over the wall, the charge end firmly anchored in my hands. The rope jerked as the plank finished its flight, probably ending up dangling about 3 or 4 feet over the target side. Gently, I started pulling it back, waiting for the bit of resistance that would tell me that the point where the rope was wrapped around the plank had connected with the far top edge of the wall. The way this thing worked was that the counterweight of the brick made the top of the plank anchor itself against an angled wall. It's one of the reasons why prisons have a large oval shape made of smooth metal on top of their walls, so that contraptions like this don't have anything to bite into. MI9 had done it again. Maintaining the tension in the rope, and half expecting the plank to come plummeting back down onto my head at any second, I slowly let it take my whole body weight. The cheap nylon rope stretched and protested but held secure. With my feet against the wall, and using the pitted sections as toeholds and knots I'd placed along the rope, I started to climb. It didn't take long to reach the top, and I scrambled up and rested along its 3-foot width. The large building blocked most of my view of the target beyond. All I could see was the light from the windows where it hit the snow. The generator now provided a constant rumble in the foreground. Snow and ice cascaded from the wall as I swiveled round on my stomach, turning to face the way I'd come. With my legs now dangling down the target side, I began to pull the charges carefully up the wall. It wasn't the noise I was worried about. I didn't want to damage them. When I'd finally got the charges up on top with me, I swiveled round again and lowered them gently down the target side. It was now simply a question of moving the plank to the other edge in order to reverse the climbing process. Keeping the tension in the rope, I slowly lowered myself over, twisting my right foot round the rope as my hips got to the edge of the wall. Then I let the rope take my weight and climbed down as quickly as I could. I piled snow on top of the charges so the weight of the plank didn't pull it down the other side, taking everything with it. It was important to keep the rope in place while I went off and did a quick recce. For now, it was my only escape route. The hum of the generator was louder at ground level, more than enough to drown the crunch of my feet on virgin snow and ice as I moved towards the rusty side door. I took the torch from my pocket and switched it on. Just a tiny pinprick of light emerged. I'd taped over most of the reflector, leaving just a small hole. There was work to be done on the door. It's all well and good getting onto a target, but it's just as important getting away. If I didn't have a better escape route organized than just climbing up a rope, I'd be in deep shit if I was compromised. Working with the torch in my mouth, I could see that the door was secured by a large bolt, maybe 2 feet long, set in the middle, covered in rust, and looking as if it hadn't been opened for years. I began to work on the lever with both hands, gently lifting it up and down as I pulled it back and forth, making a little progress with each movement until the thing finally gave. Pulling the door towards me about 3 or 4 inches to confirm that it would open, I then pushed it back into position. Job done. I stopped and listened. No noise but the generator. There was no point in risking the rope being spotted now that I had an alternative escape route, so I untied it and let it go. Shouldering the charges, I crunched along the front of the larger building, trying to keep as close to it as possible to minimize sign. Now I could see that it was built of chalk-colored bricks that were way past their prime. If the target house was built of the same stuff, it wasn't going to be difficult to make entry. The generator noise increased as I reached the large opening. A mass of tire tracks led in the same direction. Going inside, I moved off to the right so I wasn't silhouetted in the entrance and stood still in the darkness, listening to the jenny noise to my far left. It felt warmer in here, but I knew it wasn't really. It was just more sheltered. Taking the torch out of my pocket, I pulled off the tape but kept 2 fingers over the lens to control its brightness. A quick shine around the cavernous interior revealed 3 vehicles. A Mercedes box van with its nose pointing out, and 2 saloons haphazardly parked at different angles pointing in. The floor was concrete, covered in several years' supply of frozen mud, lumps of wood and old crates. The torchlight was too weak to reach the generator itself, but 30 paces took me right up to it. The machinery was standing on a new section of concrete floor, about 2 feet above ground level, to keep it well out of the shit. Beyond it was the fuel tank, a large, heavy plastic cylinder supported on breeze blocks. Seeing it gave me an idea for later on. Jutting from the front of the generator was a power cable, a good 3 inches thick. It ran through the gable wall, where 3 or 4 bricks had been knocked out to accommodate it, and towards the target house. I dumped my kit at the back of the generator, turned off the torch, and went back to the large opening and out into the compound. Following the many footprints that had been made between this building and the target, about 15 meters away, I made my way towards the main door. Directly ahead, I saw the triangle of darkness that stretched from directly below the ground floor windowsill to about 1 meter out into the snow, where the light hit the ground. I checked my weapon was properly placed in my jacket pocket so that, if needed, I could bite off my glove and draw down with ease. Checking, before passing the 2 meter gap between the 2 buildings to my right, I could see where the generator cable came out of the barn wall and went into the targets. I also saw plenty of footprints from the track I was on, branching off between the 2 buildings and towards the rear of the target. People must be in and out of here all the time. bending down. I edged my way under the first window, as close as possible to the wall. The glass above me was protected by steel bars. A television was on. The voices were English, and it didn't take me long to work out the channel was MTV. This got weirder by the minute. With my back to the wall, I looked and listened. The light above me was shining through yellow floral curtains, though the material was too thick to see through. I couldn't hear any talking, just Ricky Martin singing. Putting my ear to the wall, I listened again. I didn't have to try hard. Bursting in with the chorus was a heavy Eastern European accent, trying to give Ricky a hand. Chapter 40. The target building seemed to consist of a concrete frame, infilled with red clay brickwork with air holes and serrated sides. Whoever had put it together had never heard of a plumb line, and too many bad winters had taken their toll on the bricks. They looked as crumbly as the one I'd tied to the plank. With Ricky Martin reaching the end of his song, I moved up the two concrete steps to the main door. It was the same arrangement as the bar in Narva, except the other way round, with the steel grill on the outside and the wooden door set back about 6 inches further into the frame. I needed to find out if it was locked. It wasn't my chosen point of entry, but if the charges didn't work and the door happened to be open, at least I'd have options. More to the point, if I fucked up inside, I had an extra escape route. The grill wasn't locked. I moved it gently backwards an inch, and it made no noise. So I pulled it towards me a couple of inches, returned it an inch, and pulled another two, controlling the quiet squeaks as it gradually opened. Eventually the grill was open enough to squeeze my arm past and try the door. There were no sounds apart from MTV and the generator as I pushed the door handle down gently and gave a small push. It was locked. I stood and listened, hoping to hear Tom's voice. Something was being fried, and the smell was wafting under the door. From upstairs came a shout, muffled by the sound of the TV, but it wasn't Tom's voice. Then I realized the shouting wasn't shouting. It was meant to be singing. My friend, the Ricky Martin impressionist, was on his way back downstairs. Moving out of the doorway, I pulled my glove off with my teeth and gripped my weapon. If he came out, I'd be stepping over his dead body and going straight in with so much speed, aggression, and surprise that I'd scare even myself. His voice got louder as he reached the ground floor. A chorus of other voices bellowed from the rear of the building, maybe in Russian, but definitely telling him to shut the fuck up. He had reached the hallway and was only feet from the door, shouting back, along with at least two other voices from the TV room. It was banter, nothing more. The singer went back into the room and the MTV show died down to a slightly quieter level as the door was closed. I moved back to the front door and listened. Nothing now but the sound of more music being played. Replacing my weapon, I slowly closed the grill the same way as I'd opened it. Moving back down the steps, I followed the tracks towards the far end of the target, ducking under the left-hand window and into its dark triangle. Even with my ear to the wet, cold wall, I could hear no sound from inside. The windows were steamed up behind the steel bars. Maybe this was the kitchen. I reached the corner of the building and cleared it. There were no windows this side, but plenty of footprints in the snow leading to the rear. What could easily be seen, however, even in this light, was a large satellite dish, slightly jutting out to the left of the building and pointing upwards at about 45 degrees. I felt as if I was having a Microsoft HQ flashback, and hoped the NSA didn't arrive to complete this story. At the same time, I was pleased I'd seen it. The dish was my only confirmation that this really was the target. I counted the paces as I moved towards it, in preparation for laying the charges. 17 one-yard steps took me to the rear of the building. I cleared the corner and the generator gained a decibel or two. Lights were shining through curtains from both of the upstairs windows, just enough to cast a dim glow over the satellite dish's two mates. All three were about the same size as those at Microsoft HQ, but made of solid plastic, not mesh. They pointed skywards in different directions. They weren't static, dug-in dishes, but on stands, with ice-covered sandbags over the legs to keep them in position. Like the Finnish ones, they too were clear of snow and ice, and the whole area around them was trampled down. Beyond them, maybe 40 meters away, was the dark shape of the rear compound wall. I turned the corner and realized that hidden in the shadow of the top window's dark triangles were two more windows on the ground floor, without light. All four mirrored the ones on the front of the target. To get under the first window took 5 paces, making it 22 in total so far. I crouched by 3 thick, snow-covered satellite feeds which came out of the snow and disappeared into a hole in the brickwork directly beneath the first ground-floor window. The gap around the cabling was roughly refilled with concrete. The downstairs windows on this side were also barred. I could now see chinks of light around the edges of the frame I was crouching beneath. Lifting my eyes to the sill for a closer look, I saw that the glass was boarded over from the inside. I heard a humming noise coming from the other side of the boards, high-pitched and electrical, unlike the throbbing diesel further along in the other building. No human voices, but I knew they were there somewhere. I never thought I'd find myself longing to hear Tom asking for a cup of herbal tea. "My body's a temple. Know what I mean, Nick?" But it didn't happen. Stepping over the cables, it took me another 9 slow and careful paces to the next window to add to the 22. I'd soon know how much debt cord I'd need to take off the reel. This window was also boarded up, but there was a little more light spilling out. 2 sheets of quarter-inch ply, which should have been flush against the glass, were not, leaving a half-inch gap on the right-hand side. Doing a Houdini, I adjusted my head to try and get a good viewing angle, pressing it right up against the iron bars, the hat working as a perfect insulator for my head. I got a glimpse of very bright lighting, under which I could see a bank of about 5 or 6 grey plastic PC monitors facing away from me, their rear vents black with burned dust. Judging from what I could see, this rear half of the building was one big room. As I adjusted my head in another attempt to see more, everything inside went dark. A body blocked my view. I watched as he leaned forward on his arms, his head moving from side to side as he studied the different screens in front of him, no more than 2 feet away from me. He must have been about mid-30s, with short, dark blonde hair on top of a very square head. And he was wearing a patterned crewneck jumper that any train spotter's mother would have been proud of. He started to smile, then nodded to himself as he turned towards the gap. He was no more than a foot away now as he answered a quick, aggressive Russian voice behind him. He looked down at something, and whatever it was, he was happy about it. Maybe Tom had come up with the goods for them and they had Echelon. If so, it wouldn't be for long. He picked up a sheet of printed A4 and waved it at whoever was behind him. Then he moved out of my line of vision back into the room. It was probably the Christmas lunch menu from the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command in San Diego. They seemed to know everything else that was happening there. At least I knew where the kit that had to be destroyed was. All I needed to find now was Tom. I waited for further movement for another 15 minutes with my eye to the gap, but nothing happened. I was getting very cold and my toes were numb. Lion King told me it was only 5:49. It was going to get a whole lot colder yet. I moved to the next corner of the target, towards the generator. It was another 5 paces, which made 36 in total. I was happy. There was more than enough debt cord. I turned right and walked down the small gap between the two buildings, stepping over the generator cable lying in the snow. Just as with the satellite cables, a hole had been punched through the target's brickwork, and the gap refilled with handfuls of concrete. I made my way back to the generator building and started to prepare the kit. The first thing I checked was that I still had the batteries in my inside pocket. In DEMS, it's the ultimate sin to lose control of the initiation device, on a par with leaving your weapon more than an arm's length away from you. I'd been keeping them close to my body to stop them getting sluggish in the cold, They needed to work first time. I didn't need light for unrolling the debt cord because I knew what I was doing. But the generator noise would drown out any human movement coming into the building, so I had to keep my eyes on the entrance while I was working. Placing the reel between my feet, I held the loose end in my right hand and stretched out my arm, pushing the debt cord into my armpit with my left. I did that 36 times, plus an extra 5 to cover what I needed to do on the wall this side of the target. I added 2 more for luck, cutting it with my blackened Leatherman. I then laid it on the floor next to the charges. This was now called the main line, and would be used to send the shockwave to all the charges at once via their debt tails. The next thing I had to sort out was the little brainwave I'd had for the fuel tank. What I had in mind was the most spectacular explosion this side of Hollywood. When the fuel tank blew, it wouldn't be the most productive bang in the world, but the effect would be phenomenal. I climbed the ladder of the tank with the debt cord in my hand, slowly unfeeding it from the reel. When I lifted the flap on the tank, the torch beam hit on the surface of shiny liquid that filled about 3/4 of the cylinder. After tying a double knot on the end of the cord, I pulled the petrol station carrier bag from my jacket. In it was the spare 4-pound ball of PE that any Dems man worth his salt always carries to plug up any holes or damage to a charge. The smell wasn't too bad out in the open, as I ripped off about half and played with it to warm it up. Once it was pliable enough, I squashed it around the double knot, ensuring it had worked its way into the gaps of the ties. Finally, I taped the whole thing up to keep the PE in place. I lowered the ball of PE into the tank by its string of debt cord, stopping when it was dangling about 2 or 3 inches from the surface of the fuel. It only takes a split second for fuel to vaporize after an explosion, but when that detonates, the effect is Vesuvian. If I fucked up this job, it would certainly give the appearance that I'd given it my best shot. How could Val doubt my word when the fireball would probably be big enough for him to see it in Moscow? I taped the debt cord onto the side of the fuel tank, then climbed back down the ladder, carefully unreeling the rest of the cord as I moved towards the hole in the wall. I wanted to cut a long enough length so that, once laid out, it would reach the target house. 9 extra arms' lengths seemed to put me on the safe side. I made the cut, then started to push the end of the debt cord through the hole in the wall. Just then, torchlight came bouncing down the gap from the front of the buildings. I couldn't hear anything above the generator. I quickly pulled the debt cord back in and froze. The only things moving were my eyes. They flicked from the hole to the entrance, waiting for any movement from either direction. A shiny, wet pair of wellies and a pair of normal outdoor boots were illuminated by the beam of light as it searched for the generator cable. What worried me was the AK welly man had hanging down by his side, its large foresight at the end of the barrel level with his knees. Once over it, they carried on towards the rear and moved out of sight. There wasn't any talking, or if there was, I couldn't hear it above the generator. I didn't even hear their feet in the snow. They must have been doing something with the dishes. I waited. There was nothing else I could do. No way was I going out there again until I knew they were safely tucked up back in the house. I lay on the frozen mud and waited for their return, my eyes still moving between the gaps in the brickwork. The cold soon penetrated my clothing, numbing my skin. The 6 or 7 minutes it took before I saw the torchlight flickering about on the snow again didn't pass quickly enough. Craning my neck to get a better view, I watched their silhouettes fade as they reached the corner of the building. I waited a few more frozen minutes in case they'd forgotten something or realized they'd fucked up and had to come back to redo it. While I waited, I had another brainwave. When I eventually got to my feet, I went across to the vehicles and let down their tires. The fireball ought to sort out the vehicles and guarantee they couldn't be used in a follow-up, but it didn't hurt to play safe.